like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order for the Oregon State Legislature. It is Monday, April 2nd. Today we have two bills scheduled. House Bill 2871, scheduled for work session today, and House Bill 2735, scheduled for public hearing. We will not be working that bill today. We will not have a work session on that bill, but we will be having hearing on it. And my intent is I'm going to start out with House Bill 2735, and we'll probably stop at some point and do the work session at 2871 and probably reopen 2735 after that. So with that, I would like to open the public hearing on House Bill 2735. And I'd like to bring up John Van Landingham, Pat Schlock, and Chuck Carpenter. Give us a little remembrance of the bill. Would you please, Steve?
Thank you, Chair Holvey. House Bill 2735 establishes a payment obligation for a manufactured home park owner closing a manufactured dwelling park or a portion of the park.
Thank you. And Mr. Van Landingham, if you would like to state your name for the record, and or whoever wants to go first, I guess that's appropriate, too.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. My name is John Van Landingham. I work as a legal aid lawyer in Lane County in Eugene on East 11th. We three were able to testify at your first hearing. And I know there are a lot of people here who were not able to testify at that first hearing and who want to do so. And so I won't take time to repeat the testimony that I gave before. You've heard a number of arguments, both in that hearing and, I believe, in subsequent contacts from people who are opposed to 2735 for various reasons. And I've just had your staff distribute a memo that I prepared in which I've tried to respond to those arguments. Let me focus only on one of those arguments and certainly be glad to take questions about any of the other issues that have come up. And again, what I'm hoping to do is to respond to concerns that I believe that you are hearing from other people about this bill. The one issue that I want to raise on my own is preemption. The current bill is not the final bill. We've asked for some significant amendments. I don't believe they've come back from legislative council, at least not as far as I've heard. The bill, as we intend it, would include a preemption of local governments adopting regulations regulating park closures, and that would apply to existing local government ordinances as well. So no grandparenting of existing ordinances. There are four cities that currently have an ordinance. Eugene was the first. I was heavily involved in the adoption of Eugene's ordinance in 1988. Wilsonville adopted an ordinance, and then Bend and Oregon City have adopted similar ordinances to what Wilsonville adopted. The bill language would prohibit those cities from applying those ordinances or any future ordinance unless a closure notice was already given. That's significant, because the park closure that prompted Wilsonville's ordinance, Thunderbird Park, has given its closure notice. If the bill passes, Wilsonville would not be preempted from applying its current ordinance to the Thunderbird Park. It's an important point to understand. But let me explain why we negotiated preemption. I have said this, and I will say it again. I am prepared to trade four cities for the rest of the state. I have been involved in this issue for a long time. I feel like I've done nothing but park closures since September of 2005. So it's more than a year and a half. I am very active in Lane County. I participated in an effort recently to update Eugene's ordinance, which doesn't really do much now. I believe that Eugene, without 2735, would probably update its ordinance and make it better. I do not believe that Lane County would. I do not believe that Springfield would. I do not believe that Florence would, or Cottage Grove, or Cresswell, or Coburg, or any of the other cities in Lane County that have mobile home parks that are at risk of closure. If we want regulation of park closures statewide, I believe that 2735 is the only way to get it. Now, we have agreed in the coalition to preemption. My own personal preference would be not to have preemption. But it was a condition of the landlords. The tenant side has its own conditions. And if the landlords balked at those conditions, we would pull out of the deal. That includes requiring that landlords pay more money than they're required to pay now, which essentially is zero. It includes that landlords apply this protection for conversions as well as closures. It's complicated, but parks can be converted to subdivisions and closed that way, just as well as being closed and redeveloped. So we've had our conditions, and we've said that without those conditions, no deal. The landlords have said to the tenants, without preemption, no deal. We have a number of cities which I believe would welcome state regulation. And there are various reasons for that. Some cities don't like mobile home parks. That's why we have a state statute that prohibits cities from discriminating against mobile home parks. Some cities are concerned, or local governments are concerned, about private property rights. I believe that Douglas County, for example, will not ever adopt regulation of a mobile home park closure because of its views about private property rights. Some cities are concerned about the complexity of the issue. There's competing arguments on both sides. An example of that is Sherwood, which I believe had a split vote at its council about adopting a Wilsonville-style ordinance and did not adopt, and was quoted in the paper saying that they wished that the state would regulate the subject. Some cities are worried about the cost to defend. West Lynn was one of the first cities to consider adopting a Wilsonville-style ordinance and didn't do it because of fear of the cost to defend litigation over that ordinance. And some cities and local governments are worried about the cost to develop and administer it. I can't imagine any county, and I'm in one, that is now dependent on federal funds taking on a new administrative duty. Kerr County is talking about bankruptcy. There are parks in Kerr County. How would Kerr County ever regulate a park closure? It just isn't going to happen. This is not the perfect bill for park tenants. Chair Hobie has shared that thought with me. I think he's right. It's not the perfect bill for park tenants. It's the best bill that we could get at this time. This coalition has existed for 5 previous sessions. This is our 6th. We've built some trust and some relationships. When we started, we didn't trust each other at all. We've addressed significant issues in those 5 years. Each session of those 5, we have produced an omnibus bill in which we agreed to change things. We have done things such as require landlords to be educated. We've addressed forced closure, abandoned property, habitability, sub-metering utilities, a number of significant issues. We have other issues that we still need to address. We expect to be back in 2009 and 2011. We cannot come back as a coalition if we as tenants betray the landlords in terms of the deal that we've negotiated. It's as simple as that. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat.
Yes, thank you, Chair Holby, and members of the committee. I have a couple of things that I will hand out to the committee since I testified briefly the last time. One of them is written by Mike Quitty, who was a
member. Your name for the record,
I'm
please.
Sorry. Pat Flock, Manufactured Homeowners. I live in Newburg, Oregon. I'm executive director for Manufactured Homeowners of Oregon. And this, the particular one that I want to talk about, one of them is my husband's, and I know what he had to say, so I won't read that to you. Mike Quitty sent his comments in because he was called out of town. And he talks about the fact that we certainly had resident representatives in this coalition. There were a couple of us who live in parks. Mike lives in a park, and as he says, his main concern is that the residents in the park are well treated. And so with the 3 of us and 3 attorneys, we did pretty well with representation, I do believe. He talks about Wilsonville's ordinance, and again, I'm not going to get into it. I have copies for everybody, and I know this is going to be a long afternoon, so I'll just hand these out. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Holby, Chuck Carpenter, Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, and I reside in Portland. I'd like to thank Pat and John Van Landingham for their hard work over the last 2 years, since the end of the last session, working on park closure. It's something that the three of us have been focused on. And I agree with John that we have done a lot of significant legislation over my tenure as executive director in the last 8 years. And we've come up with some really good legislation because we've worked together, and it becomes very evident when you look at nationwide what happens in individual states, particularly on this issue. Nobody has come up with a good resolution to this issue and to many other issues that are particular to manufactured housing communities. Obviously, my organization, the landlords, would be very much opposed to having the preemption removed from this bill. We see it, from our point of view, as the heart and soul of this legislation. And also, really, from the standpoint of trying to bring some stability to this market, which has been ravaged by various things over the last 8 years, the most recent being the park closure issue. And every time a local newspaper or television station runs a story about a public hearing or ordinances being passed that affect residents and landlords and the property owners in a very negative way, all of us in this industry suffer. And so we felt that it was incumbent upon us to work with the residents to try to come up with a solution that was statewide that would alleviate this every 6 months having a local ordinance, whether it is Sherwood or Eugene or Medford or wherever it may be in the state, from dealing with a park closure by coming out with some onerous local ordinance that gets plastered across the media, and then all of a sudden not only do the residents in that community suffer that is closing, but all residents and all landlords who own manufactured home communities in Oregon. Because until we can bring this issue to some rest, then we are not going to have stability in the market. And that really serves everybody. It serves everybody not in this state by being covered by this statewide, knowing that there is going to be some relief if, in the unlikely event that park closes, there will be some support for them, whether they live in wherever they live in the state of Oregon. But for the rest of us who live in manufactured home communities, and for those communities, many of them, probably over 1,200 in the state, that will continue to be viable in this state, some vitality will be brought back to them because we get this issue off the table and we can get back to being focused on affordable, quality housing for people in the state of Oregon. So we would urge you to keep the preemption there so that we can stay at the table with the residents, so that we can continue to work on issues that all residents and all landlords in this industry face that need to be resolved, and to help us actually bring some stability to the market so that all residents of the state can sell their homes in their communities and get on with their lives, and we can bring this issue to closure. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
No, I just thank you. I want to welcome Chuck Carpenter back into the building. He used to be my representative.
No. Thank you.
Thank you for that.
Before you step down, I you know, something still kind of bothers me a little bit, and I kind of want to know if you can speak to, I guess, the perception when people move into mobile home parks that they're leasing for a certain period of time. And, you know, because I've heard from, as you can imagine, a lot of people who kind of felt like they were retiring and had something similar to a 99-year lease on their park. And so this is sort of an abrupt, development for many folks out there. And can you briefly describe what a normal lease, if there is such a thing, for a mobile home park is, and for what length of time?
Chair Holvey, I'd respond to that if I might, since I've lived in parks off and on for 30-some years, and that is that without fail, the rental agreements and the statement of policy always says that the owner has the right to close the park. And we didn't think it would happen for a long period of time, but it's very obvious as we see property becoming more expensive and less of it out there, that these parks, there are going to be some of them, they're going to close. But fortunately, we also have a lot of park owners who are going to keep these parks as viable places for us to live. But it's there for anybody that wants to look at it. that they can close.
If I could add, Chair Hovey, John Van Lanningham, the state first regulated manufactured housing parks, the relationship between landlords and tenants, in 1975. The very first bill allowed parks to close on less notice than is required now. So it has always been part of the deal that parks could close and convert to another use. This is not a new idea. And in fact, in the late 70s, there was a public controversy over some park closures in Salem. Legislature amended the law to require a longer period of notice, and if there was a shorter period of notice, the landlords had to pay some money, not very much money. But it's not a new issue. From the tenant side, I don't believe that landlords emphasize the fact that the park can be closed. We've talked about that quite a bit within the coalition, about maybe we should have something on the front of a new rental agreement in big, bold print that says, look out, your park could be closed. That would not be particularly helpful to those residents who are in parks and trying to sell their homes. So we kind of have a split view among the residents. The current residents would suffer from some proposal like that. The future residents would be warned off of moving in a park. We also have a lot of park owners who we believe are committed to maintaining their parks forever, and if they have to dispose of them some way, that they were committed to selling them to a nonprofit or a resident group or another private landlord. So some park residents, I think, can expect to have a tenancy that lasts forever. But there is no legal limitation on closures. Most park tenancies are month-to-month tenancies. They can be terminated only for cause on a 30-day notice or for a park closure. If that answers your question, I don't know if it makes you feel any better, but it doesn't necessarily make us feel any better, but it's the deal, and we don't have a way to make that a better deal right now. Might be a reason for staying together as a coalition.
That's probably a good reason.
Thank you for that clarification. It did answer my question. Next up, I'd like to have Gary Davis, Ernie Howell, and Fernando Gappison, I think. Thank you. Go ahead and get started. Whoever wants to start first, state your name for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Chairman Holvey and committee members. My name is Gary Davis. I'm a resident of a mobile home park in Eugene located at 1699 North Terry. I'm not testifying for myself alone, but represent 628 residents in my park and surrounding areas that have signed our written testimony. We are here to address the threat that many of our mobile home parks may be closed to provide land for site-built housing. We are opposed to House Bill 2735. We believe it is morally wrong for park owners to gain substantial profit while inflicting great harm to our residents. Many of these persons are elderly, disabled, or on low incomes. We believe that our local community leaders are best prepared to understand the circumstances affecting our situation. We are alarmed to have learned that House Bill 2735 has a provision that would preempt all the good work accomplished by our local leaders. We have learned it may cost more than $20,000 to move a home. Should we abandon our homes for lack of moving costs? Plus, some homes cannot be moved due to their age or physical condition. We are concerned that this bill fails to provide adequate compensation in the event a home must be vacated due to the lack of any alternate space available, the lack of upfront funds to pay for a move, or discrimination based on a home's age, size, or condition. As an example, House Bill 2735 provides only a maximum payment of $17,000. $10,000 of that comes from taxpayers for a double wide. Most homes are worth many times that and or may have mortgages greater than that. Many homeowners thus may face bankruptcy and the prospect of becoming homeless. House Bill 2735 is good for park owners, bad for tenants. This is another piece of legislation protecting wealthy land developers at the expense of taxpayers. Thank you, Chairman Halvey, for this opportunity to speak for 628 of my neighbors, and I would like to present our testimony.
Chairman Halvey, members of the House Consumer Protection Committee, good afternoon. My name is Ernie Howell. I live in Saddle Butte Mobile Manor, 295 Olivia Lane, Roseburg. I'm Vice President of Saddle Butte Residents Association and a veteran of the Persian Gulf War. Saddle Butte has over 290 manufactured homes. Currently, the owner plans closure and eviction of half of our residents who construct site-built houses on the property. This would leave them unto an unstable housing market and at the mercy of an already overdrawn welfare assistance network. I'm here today to urge you to delete the preemption clause in House Bill 2735. Preemption would close the door for stronger protection from local laws. We appreciate your committee and the full House passing legislation on forming cooperative purchase associations, similar to the successful models in New Hampshire. At Saddle Butte, we've been looking into buying our parks since November 06, increasing the purchase offer time in HB 2735 to 90 days or more would be helpful to all, present and future. All too often, our devotion to honoring the hardships endured by the greatest generation is replaced by renewed patriotism for our current troops overseas. Generation after generation, their sacrifices are fading into distant memory. Let me tell you, those sacrifices are not forgotten by the dozens of Saddle Butte residents and their veteran families. They lived through them. They honor them. Tens of thousands of Oregonian veterans, including more than 18,000 in Douglas County, and dozens of Saddle Butte veteran families, are well aware of what it means to honor our veterans. Now you sit in a position to honor and protect the homes and livelihoods of veterans in their retirement years. Welcome to Douglas County. We honor veterans. Travelers are greeted with this sign upon entering Douglas County. At Saddle Butte, we have battle-weary veterans of three wars, a soldier mom in Iraq, even one of 14 miraculous survivors of the USS Indianapolis, torpedoed, sunk, and floating for days in the Indian Ocean. Some made the ultimate sacrifice and are survived only by their families. These people are heroes by any definition of the word. All of our freedoms and our very lives were once in their hands. We now have our wonderful democratic lives to thank them for. I choose to speak up and honor Saddle Butte and Douglas County veterans. Will you also speak up and honor all veterans of Oregon? It would be a shame to have to amend our county sign to "We honor almost all veterans." For the honor of our great state, our country, and for the sake of your own honor, thank you for your own time. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Chairman Halvey and the other members of the House Consumer Protection Committee of State Oregon. My name is Fernando Gapacin. I am the president of Central Oregon Labor Council, AFL-CIO, and the chair of Tenants United for Fairness. And until recently, I was a member of the City of Bend's Affordable Housing Committee. I am one of the primary authors of the mobile home closure ordinance that was recently passed in Bend. And speaking in behalf of the Central Oregon Labor Council, which represents 5,000 union men and women in Central Oregon, I wish to express our opposition to the preemption clause in HB 2735. Our local ordinance was created in the wake of skyrocketing housing costs, which until recently have been a boon to developers. Regular working folks find it very difficult to find affordable housing in Bend. There are many union members, including myself, who are residents of mobile home parks. And for the record, I live at 1001 Southeast 15th Street, Space 51, in the Suntree Mobile Home Park. As you all know, in 2006, Bend had the highest percentage increase in housing costs in the entire U.S. Our mobile home ordinance not only helps to preserve the most affordable housing, which is manufactured homes in mobile home parks, but it also increases the rewards for building affordable housing. Our ordinance was the result of a coalition built between mobile home owners, tenants, and affordable housing advocates, and negotiated with mobile home park owners. We also created a developer's fee that created funding for the creation of affordable housing and aided displaced mobile home owner tenants. Our ordinance places most of the financial burden on the people who are making the profit from the closure of mobile home parks with minimal use of taxpayer money. It also provides rezoning and the opportunity for developers and park owners to make money by developing affordable housing. If state legislators preempt our ordinance, they would be ignoring the unique circumstances of our community and negating the collective efforts of our local civic leaders, affordable housing advocates, tenants, and park owners. Our local ordinance resulted from the social movement created by hundreds of tenants and resulted in the creation of a real coalition that represented the interests of most of Bend's population. We believe that our local ordinance is a model for other communities throughout the state of Oregon and the U.S. And we surely recognize that there is an urgent need to reform the laws regarding the closure of mobile home parks. And we believe that there is presently before this legislature alternatives to 2735. But we speak on behalf of the Central Oregon Labor Council in opposition to the preemption clause of 2735. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Appreciate your testimony today. Thanks for making
the
effort.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Next up, I'd like to have Bob Lawrence and Kitty Piercy. Evidently, Bob Lawrence isn't here.
Evidently not. Well, I'm happy to be here.
And we're happy to have you.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Nelson, and members of the committee, I'm Kitty Piercy, Mayor of Eugene, Oregon, and I'm here to speak in opposition to House Bill 2735. With all due respect to my good friend and colleague, John Van Landingham, and to my former colleague, Chuck Carpenter, the City of Eugene supports the concept of House Bill 2735, but we strongly oppose the preemption language contained in the bill. Over 20 years ago, Eugene became the first city in the state to provide protections for homeowners in manufactured home parks should a park close. We continue to want to provide the best protections possible. In recent months, the Lane County Intergovernmental Housing Policy Board, which includes Eugene, finished recommendations that would expand Eugene's current ordinance to protect all homeowners in parks. The underlying concepts of House Bill 2735 do provide some needed protections for homeowners who are at a significant risk of losing their homes. Many of these owners are elderly or low income. If their manufactured home parks close, there are very limited opportunities to relocate their homes or find alternative housing that's affordable. The City of Eugene supports the concept of statewide protections that are found in this bill and recognizes the hard work of a coalition of tenant advocates and park owners to craft a response to a serious problem. However, the City of Eugene does not support the preemptive language contained in House Bill 2735. We see no compelling reason why a local jurisdiction should be unable to protect its own residents to a greater degree than the state law would provide. We support a floor, not a ceiling. And we'd also like to make note that we have not been part of the negotiations as cities. it's time for that to happen as well. We have deep concerns for keeping affordable housing in each of our communities. To this end, we support the recommendations being made by the City of Wilsonville. Their proposed amendments would permit local governments to continue to provide needed protections for their homeowners while addressing the concerns of park owners. We care about every city in Oregon, and we care about all the individuals that reside in all those cities. Thank you for the consideration of our position, and we urge the committee adopt these necessary amendments. Thank you, Chair. Be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for Speaker C. Well, thank you for your testimony today, and I know Eugene was out in front of this issue a long time ago,
right.
and has you know, some real angst over the preemption piece. So I appreciate you making the effort to testify to us today.
Thank you very much, Chair Holby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My excuse is, my name is Robert Barnes from the Governor's Commission. I was sitting up in a legislative office watching the TV, and I heard my name, and I didn't realize how speed this hearing was going to go. So my apologies.
Okay.
Thank you.
Go for it.
I don't know. I think we should vote.
I have some written testimony that is being passed around right now, but for the record, my name is Bob Lawrence, and I'm a legislative coordinator for the Governor's Commission on Senior Services.
And Mr. Lawrence, you know, and this goes for everybody, I suppose. If you're handing out, not that you were going to, written testimony, if you could just summarize it for us.
Okay.
Instead of reading the testimony, because we can actually read if we have time. You know, we have a lot of people, and I'd like to get through as many as we can.
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
When the Governor's Commission on Senior Services went around the state to 20 different cities, one of the biggest issues that came up was affordable housing, in particular manufactured housing, as an issue that was pertinent to seniors. You've already received written testimony from us in regard to the burgeoning population of seniors in the state of Oregon. Last session's bill was clearly a stopgap measure. House Bill 2735 is a reasonable attempt for a more comprehensive solution, and we hope that what has been created so far will be the floor and not the ceiling. We appreciate the greater sharing of responsibility amongst all the parties involved. We also support the effort to extend a tax credit beyond a single biennium. We do, however, have some concerns about any solution that prevents local governments from enacting solutions that make sense for their local area. We are not certain that there is a one-size-fits-all solutions to the issues around zoning and relocation. Thank you for your consideration of my testimony.
Thank you, and I appreciate your summarizing. You summarized so much, I got to ask you a question now. And I apologize for that, but it sounds like you're in favor of the bill but against the preemption.
That is our feeling, yes. We feel like what we found out was that all of the problems that are created are local problems, and if you try to get a one-size-fits-all, I think you preempt the ability of people to come up with unique and indigenous solutions to the problem. I'm from Clackamas County, and we have the two largest parks that are controversial right now, so we have been intimately involved with this and on the advisory council, and I sincerely believe that you need to have an indigenous solution to some of the problems. So.
And I heard you also mention, you know, you would hope it would be the floor and not the ceiling, speaking to that preemption, I assume. So. How would you determine whether or not a certain ordinance was an improvement for the tenants?
I don't think that would be within my expertise or bailiwick, to tell you the truth. I think that's a local, up to the city attorneys and the local city manager and city councils. So.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your testimony
today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Well, jumping around the schedule to catch people that are up in somebody's office watching TV, we're going to call up Carolyn Fisk. Oh, Carolyn Fink, excuse me. And Paul Brewer and Lynn Grover.
Thank you. Representative Holby, committee, I'm really glad to be able to be here and speak to you. I'm speaking for an entirely...
If you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Fink, F-I-N-K.
Thank you.
Not Fink, Fink. I'm here speaking personally on a very emotional level, perhaps. But I am the sister of and conservator of Dolores and Jim Graham, who are residents of McNary Oaks. I moved them from a substandard mobile home park in McMinnville about 7 or 8 years ago because the park over there was not regulated and rather poor, and I needed to have them closer so I could help them more. Moved them over here, and they're in a lovely home. Took most of their savings to get it. They're on a very limited income because they're mentally challenged. They get together, two of them, $1,300 a month, a little over $1,300 a month. We stretch it, and we pinch it, and we budget it, and they're able to live independently and happily in a community that accepts them, they have a good life, and find that they're safe. I would hate to see that disrupted, because if the park were to close, they, like many others in the park who are on limited incomes, many who are disabled, Social Security, etc., would have a terrible time finding adequate housing. We seem to have missed the point, and these people are going to fall in the cracks. There is not affordable housing out there for most of them. We've closed down so many things, and we need to protect our people somehow or other. And it's important that we, me as an individual citizen, and you as our representatives, take care of them and make sure that they're not... McNary Oak is prime property in Kaiser right now, being eyed by a number of people, I understand, and there's possibility. But can you imagine me taking the two of them and finding them a proper place to live for the amount of money they would get for the sale of their double-wide mobile home that we spent quite a bit of money refurbishing for them? It's incomprehensible that that would happen. Please, please consider these things. And don't give local authorities the way the preemption is scary, because then everybody can make a profit. Greed reigns supreme, it seems. And I'm really concerned. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you. And if next up, state your name for the record, please.
Chair Holby and committee members, my name is Paul Brewer. I'm a director of the Oregon Park Owners Alliance and an owner of parks in Bend, Grants Pass, and McMinnville. I also am a member of the Manufactured Housing Landlord Tenant Coalition, which urges this committee's support of HB 2735. I want to assure Representative Nelson, as well as the lady adjacent to me that just spoke, that I have no intention of closing my park in McMinnville. In fact, if they have driven through that park recently, they will have noticed that surveyors out there doing topos and surveys for the expansion of it. Over the past four legislation sessions that I have been a member of the coalition, I have seen a dramatic shift of how its members tackle problems confronting our industry. the active members representing park residents, park landlords, manufacturers, dealers, and the Oregon Housing and Community Services have learned to respect and, more importantly, listen to others' ideas. When the Oregon legislation ended in 2005, the coalition members rolled up their sleeves and got to work on this particular issue. In August 2005, the coalition began monthly meetings and more recently bi-monthly meetings to address the park closure problem. Many times, smaller work sessions would get together between the formal meetings to study and research particular issues and then report back to the coalition. Some members of the coalition even traveled as far as New Hampshire and Arizona to study how other states work on this particular issue. HB 2735 was not hastily drafted, but was methodically studied and deliberated for over the past 20 months. The coalition looks at this bill as a four-legged stool: the Oregon State, park owners, park residents, and the local communities. Each a leg needs to be balanced. Some park owners, as well as some park residents, may not think this bill goes far enough. In fact, some may think that their representatives on the coalition sold them down the river. I don't think so. Members of the coalition often do not agree with each other, but over the past several years, they have become wiser and more trusting as they have learned to make decisions based on the interests of all parties involved. Let me assure this committee that no member on the coalition really likes this bill, which might mean it's the fairest bill ever drafted. Some park residents may even feel the owners should pay more. Other park owners don't like the goalposts being moved in the middle of the game and believe that park residents knew that their park could close when they signed their rental agreement. My wife definitely doesn't like it. When I informed her what I had agreed to, she asked, "Why are you giving away our kids' inheritance and our retirement?" My reply to her was, "It was the price I agreed to pay for peace." The question sometimes is asked, are park owners willing to pay more for that peace? I'd like to rephrase that question and ask, are local communities and the state of Oregon willing to pay more to balance the homeowners' needs and with the park owners' rights? Some cities have requested that this committee strike the preemption clause. They feel their local ordinance, although hastily drafted and open to litigation, are better suited for their communities. Let me remind this committee that HB 2735 was not hastily drafted, but was carefully drafted over 20 months, not too much, and that each provision of this bill is necessary to balance the stool. Also, we believe that preemption is important so that our industry, which has always conformed to statewide regulations, does not have a patchwork quilt of confusing and consistent municipal ordinances. The coalition encourages local communities to enhance this bill by providing voluntary incentives to landlords and developers to preserve and construct affordable housing. Local communities could also augment this bill by having their affordable housing department engage the services of housing coordinators and providing additional assistance to displaced residents. I believe any funds needed to provide additional assistance could come from the increased property tax revenue stream local governments will receive from the property redevelopment. In closing, I'd like to read one paragraph out of the Florida, it's real short, out of the Committee of Community Affairs, out of the Florida Senate. The closure of mobile home parks and subsequent redevelopment of such properties generally increase tax revenues for local governments. A 2006 study sponsored by FMHA, it's the Florida Manufactured Housing Association, compared using 10-year property tax revenue streams from the mobile home parks to 10-year property tax revenue streams from the same mobile home parks after redevelopment. The report found that the five mobile home park communities studied increased tax revenue to the local government by more than $53 million over that 10-year span. I want to thank fellow coalition members in reaching a consensus of this problem, and I urge this committee to pass HB 2735. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Paul, I recognized your name, and I didn't think you were going to do anything like this.
Oh.
You're a great
Thank
man.
You.
My name's Len Grover. I live in Forest Hills Mobile Estates in Carnitas, Oregon. I condensed mine down from 6 pages to one. I'm not even going to read it. I can't add anything to what this man has said. I'm hearing impaired, so I have no idea what the rest of these people said ahead of us. I know there were 4 or 5 people. I got just a word now and then, and I can't understand why they're opposed to this bill. I know the first 3 people were very definitely in favor of it. So I got it written out. You guys can read it later, because I can't add anything to what this man said. This is the kind of thing that came that we need. We need everybody working together and coming up with a situation that will solve our problems. I don't like it.
And your name
it doesn't go far enough.
And your name for the record, please.
Len Grover.
Thank you.
It's on the bottom of this, too.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate that.
Thanks. It's a model.
Next up, I'd like Charlotte Lehan and Bill Dickus. If I said that right. And I got through.
This is my city attorney, Mike Koloff, is on there somewhere.
I didn't see his name on here.
He's on there.
Oh, I'm just kidding. Thank you. Just state your name for the record, please.
Sure. Mr. Chair, my name is Charlotte Lehan. I'm the mayor of the city of Wilsonville, and we seem to be at the center of a lot of this. One of the things that I notice as I sit here and listen to things is that the issue of preemption seems to be the preeminent issue that everyone from the bill sponsors on is saying is the important issue here. And yet the interesting thing in my mind is that those impacted, particularly those 4 cities that were that are proposed to be not grandfathered, but all the cities were not part of this coalition. So we're being told that preemption was negotiated away as an element that the park owners required, and yet it was negotiated away from the parties who were not included at the table. They were not a part of the coalition. And so I would question the authority of a coalition that's made up predominantly of park owners, but particularly that did not include or invite to the table local government, especially those local governments who have slogged through, and we just heard were their hastily drafted amendments or ordinances, but in fact we spent a lot of time, most local governments more than a year, in coming up with the ordinances that we did, and we have a lot of wisdom to pass on, and we were not part of that coalition or part of that discussion, and yet the issue of preemption was negotiated away on our behalf, and now we're hearing is the crux of the issue. So I think that's doesn't make sense to me. You've heard that this is essentially the best we can get, and I don't believe that. At one point you're hearing that it's the best we can get, and yet other people are saying they think it will be improved upon. So I'm not sure about that. The other piece is that you hear that that anything is better than nothing, and other cities won't be passing ordinances. I don't think that. First off, I don't think anything is better than nothing. I think we need to do the best we can from the outset. But But also, no one is arguing against. You won't hear any of us who are arguing against preemption saying that there shouldn't be a statewide statute that addresses this issue, because we all know there are many jurisdictions that won't or don't have the ability to pass ordinances. And so that's where you hear the language about a floor rather than a ceiling. I don't think anyone thinks there shouldn't be a statewide level statute. What you're hearing is that it makes no sense across a state as broad as Oregon with property values that range from $20,000 an acre to $800,000 an acre, saying that one size fits all, that $1 amount, one compensation works across the whole state of Oregon, because it simply won't. And with that, I have written testimony that I'm submitting, so I won't belabor. And I don't know, Mr. Dickus could say something, or my city attorney was here because he was on the list last time and was cut off on the. Because we do have amendments that we'll be submitting that he's written.
Oh, so my comment about not seeing him on the list probably didn't go over real well.
He's on two lists.
So, well, thank you for that. Maybe we should give the city attorney a shot at this.
Chair, hope you don't get a speeding fine.
Chair Holby and Vice Chair Nelson and the rest of the committee, my name is Mike Holoff, and as you know, I'm city attorney for Wilsonville. My adversary in this case that we have, Mr. Dickus, is sitting just right here, and we were just in court for a couple hours on our case this morning. What I'd like to simply say is that when we proposed that preemption be eliminated, we also suggested that it be eliminated with a condition that any local ordinance provide a due process hearing as part of the process. And the reason that we did that, let me just go over, I believe I set that forth in a March 6th letter to you, but when you look at the floor and the costs and the dollars involved, they are kind of grabbed out of the air, and they are consensus, but they're still artificial and arbitrary. And the real asset value of a mobile home is generally in it being able to be sold in place in these parks. Upon closure, the value is lost because the home cannot be sold in place because there's a closure and eviction, and the vast majority of homeowners cannot afford to move their home. Even those that can afford to move have limited options because there are fewer and fewer parks, and many do not take the older and bigger mobile homes. Thus, in lots of ways, I think HB 2735 doesn't face up to the reality of the forced loss of home asset caused by closure. On the park owner side, while the principal reason to close may be to take profit from land appreciation, there may be other reasons to close, such as a catastrophic event or death, wherein the values after these events may not support the statutory relocation costs. Or even though there is land appreciation in different areas of the state or in different areas of the county, they may be different, and it may not always cover the relocation expenses. Obviously, in the Thunderbird case, that's a different ball game because we're in a very, very high valued area, and the value has appreciated tremendously in the several millions of dollars. But it may not be the same across the state. And local ordinances can address this, but if you have a due process hearing where you have that laid out, that you have to make those kinds of looks and studies to see if you really have a fair balance between the park owner and the relocation costs. And again, in some areas of our state, relocation costs are less than other areas. So actually, the one-size-fits-all is not a good approach to this. Now, we also have a check and balance on the local government that might be conducting the hearing, and that's that you have a writ of review appeal. And with that, that goes to the circuit courts. Now, if you think in terms of what happens all the time, we have land use cases, we have election law cases, we have a number of ordinance cases that go before quasi-judicial hearing the City Council and with appeal by writ of review. And the writ of review includes such things as the constitutionality of a particular ordinance, whether there's a due process excessive burden or not. So I think we have in place right now procedures that will keep the balance that if I was sitting in your position and trying to balance out these things, where I could have a floor perhaps in 2735, but allow adjustments through the local process in the ordinance, but also require that there be a due process hearing with appeal to the courts so that you have all the checks and balances that you need to have in a good system, it would be there. And so we would ask that you delete the preemption and focus in on allowing cities to have local ordinances if they also incorporate due process hearing with writ of review appeal. And Wilsonville does, I know Ben does, I believe Oregon City was, and Eugene, of course, has been a leader, and they have very, very competent counsel down there, and if they don't have that now, I'm sure that they can easily put it in. So, again, that's what we would commend to you. If, in fact, you determine not to do that, I know that Mr. Van Lenningham has recommended that you put the term appeal into Section 5. I think it would read better if you said any suit, action, or appeal, because that's a typical way that reads, and we suggest that also to go forward. You would not need to have Section 5 if you allowed and deleted preemption on the basis that we suggest. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gerard, you want to take a quick question?
This is a real quick question. And that goes to the legality of the ordinance. I'm just kind of curious, did you preempt contract law in the formation of the ordinance?
No. I know that's a the basis that is a claim that we impaired contract, but we don't believe we do impair contract, and we specifically stated in our ordinance that it did not and was not to interrupt any of the closure or eviction proceedings that you would have. So the closure and eviction would go forward. The question is, if in fact you had to pay relocation costs or acquire the home, whether there was reason to believe that those costs were overly burdensome under the circumstances or not, you would have the right to a park owner relief hearing to determine that. We put some standards in there to take a look at how you would do that, and then we also include the fact that you could appeal any of our determinations to the Court of Appeal. So if, in fact, they raise the issue, and oftentimes this happens in cases with ordinances, we will see a constitutional issue raised at the quasi-judicial hearing that is conducted, and a determination is made, and then that's taken up, and the Circuit Court can make a further determination, and Court of Appeals and Supreme Court if it goes that far. But that's a typical procedure that we have at the local level. And we do it all the time. In land use, zoning cases now go to LUBA, but oftentimes there's a planning commission that hears it. There may be an appeal to city council as the final determiner. It's usually a quasi-judicial type of hearing because it's site-oriented, and then it goes to LUBA in that case, the Special Land Use Board of Appeals. But if we had an election law contest, that would go through the same city council review after the election. Personnel made a determination on it. We have that with initiatives sometimes. So it's a typical procedure that we use.
Thank you. Next up, please.
Bill Dickus, Chairman Hovey. I'm a lawyer, and I did represent Thunderbird. I wondered if you called us three here together for any ulterior purposes, right?
I actually know.
I'm not here speaking on behalf of Thunderbird. That case is over. The court has decided that the Thunderbird ordinance is unconstitutional. And it has also decided that it's preempted because under standard case law, a city may not prohibit what state law permits. But I'm not here to talk about preemption, and I'm not here to talk about the case unless you have questions. There's a solution to the problem that permeates this room, but the solution isn't in 2735. I live in a houseboat mortgage, and I'm here speaking for myself. It was a rental houseboat mortgage. It was governed by every law that you have before you until we converted it to an owner-occupied. We bought the land. We bought the rights to the lease, and now we own those slips. The only solution to closure is to increase the opportunities as much as possible for the members, for the tenants, to buy their own parks and to help them at every point you can to help them finance that purchase. That way you won't run into the constitutional issues, the 12 of them, that were raised in the Thunderbird case, including impairment of contract, because they will then be governors of their own destiny. Then they will have perpetual rights in the land. Then they will have something that appreciates instead of depreciates. And that solution I've put into my memo. I've passed it around. I don't know if you've seen it yet. The problem with 2735 is twofold. Number one, you're not doing anything to preserve the homes. Some tenants, those that are experiencing closure, if it's enforceable, they'll get some money. But where do the homes go? They go to the landfills. And you're talking 5% of all the homes in Oregon, and you're talking the most affordable homes in Oregon, and you're designing a system to throw them all away for a little bit of money, half out of your pocket, which is certainly constitutional if you want to do it, the other half out of the landlord's pocket, and they're certainly welcome to pay it if they want to. But with 1,400 mobile home parks, something tells me you're going to have a few people, like perhaps Mr. Brewer's wife, who may object. And there are legitimate, valid objections. The objection being most eloquently stated by the park owner from Irigan who came to the last meeting. He said, I run a small park in Irigan. I don't remember his name. And over the last 7 years, before taxes, I've never made more than $30,000 a year off this park. And this bill will force me to pay $235,000 to close. Now, for the big parks, it's 5 or 10 times that much to close. What have they done to deserve that penalty? Nothing. Do the tenants need it? Absolutely. But they won't need it if they own their own parks. And if you took the money that it's going to require to fund this bill, because it's going to be much more expensive than your tax credit from last session, if you took the money and put it in the park purchase account and let them borrow it at 2.5% interest or zero, I don't care. Nobody cares. If you took that same amount of money, put it in that park, you'll never have an unavoidable closure with very rare exceptions, because they can buy the land they live on, and what they own will double in value. That's all.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici, a quick question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Mr. Dickus, is it Dickus?
That's right.
I represent House District 34, which is in Washington County, and some of the parks that are closing in my district are on a corner. And across one street is Nike, and across the other street is Tektronix. So the problem with your proposed solution, while it might work in some areas, is that there's no chance that the people who live in those parks, no matter how much money is in a park purchase account, are going to be able to afford the multi-millions of dollars that it's going to take to buy that land. So the concern I have is that you're suggesting that the solution is to make sure that tenants can buy the land, and I'm saying that that's not a reality in some areas of this state.
Well, I'm not sure that it's as much a problem as you think. Take Thunderbird, which is probably the most valuable land under a mobile home park in the state. At least it's close. And Mr. Ashe testified his land was worth $30,000, or $30 million. It's 60 acres, and the brokers are telling him it's $500,000 an acre. Would it make sense to keep a $10,000 or $20,000 mobile home on land that valuable? I don't know. But for $100,000 per tenant, they could buy it at $30 million. Now, does it make sense to pay $100,000 for a $25,000 mobile home on the lot? That's not a decision for the lender to make. That's a decision for the tenants to make. But it's doable because they're collecting over $1 million a year when those spaces are full in rents now. If those rents were converted to purchase payments back to the purchase account, you could probably even do it with Thunderbird, and they might end up with $150,000 or $200,000 homes.
Thank you for your testimony today and a new approach to the problem we're looking at. Appreciate that. I'm going to have to move pretty quickly with the last testifiers. I apologize for that. Vivian Fairbairn and Doreen Carnahan, maybe? Doreen Carnahan, did I say that right?
Yes.
And again, if you have written testimony for us, please don't read it. If you can just summarize it. I've just got a few minutes left. I'd like to get a couple more people up here to speak to. But give us your point.
My name is Vivian Fairbairn. I will summarize, but I can also talk very fast, so I could do it in 3 minutes. Representative Bonamici, my parents lived in Beaverton Mobile Lodge for 30 years. My mother died 5 years ago, and my dad moved in with me. I had to quit my job to take care of him, so affordable housing was mobile home parks, and he was used to the lifestyle. So we moved into Baseline Woods. At that point, we had not had a park closure in 30 years, so people became complacent. And so anyway, so I could sell my house for 70% loss, or I could move it. I estimated the cost to be, I'm summarizing, $25,000 to move the house. I cashed in my savings and my life insurance policy. Knowing the tax credit of $10,000 for this year helped make the decision as it would allow me to replace part of my retirement savings account. Then my father passed away 2 days before move-out. I was already committed to the move, but now I didn't have a job and only nominal income. It was another month before I could get into the park and get things set up. By the way, I moved into McMinnville, Old Stone Village, based on Paul Brewer's promises. I love it out there. As you can see from my list that I've given you the second page, the cost to move a home is $25,000. It would cost an additional $15,000 to $25,000 if they hired a full-service contractor. I became my own contractor, did my own permits, arranged my own contractors to do the work. How many senior citizens can take on that responsibility? The compromise being discussed here today is well-balanced and provides a financial start for a new life for many seniors. It at least helps find a housing solution. I still think we have to have affordable housing, as been talked about before today, with our seniors. We have to have something where they can go to. There are no 1,600-square-foot single-level homes available in their communities for $600 a month. And where are they going to get the money if they can sell their home? And we're talking about manufactured homes that are only 5 or 10 years old that are worth $50,000 to $100,000. I'm happy with what I did. I like the park. I'm in Paul's Park. I don't think I would do it again. It was a very stressful move, and especially trying to take care of my father. But the most important part of this right now today, this package, is the freeze on local governments making their own policy. I've been involved in following the master plan for Oregon for many years, and I think the counties have master plans. And even if you had local governments involved that didn't want the state to supersede, at least that there could be counties involved in master plans. If McMinnville passed an ordinance, what would happen to poor little Dundee? But if we had a master plan for the whole county that would affect local governments for preemption, that would make sense. Otherwise, I support the state. Thanks. What was I talking about?
Thank you.
She was very eloquent. Ladies and gentlemen of the chair of the committee, my name is Doreen Carnahan. I belong to Thunderbird Mobile Park. And I sent a picture around to show you what some of the people are going through. They are crushing their homes. They have nothing to move with. It's a terrible situation. Oregon and Washington have a high incidence of parks closing. My daughter-in-law called me yesterday. She said in Salt Lake, just outside of Draper, Walmart bought their place. And the people are moving, and they have given them a small amount of money, and they have set up an account for them. We don't have that. We have nothing yet. And the law that has been into effect is just no longer, it's pretty passe. And I want to thank you for your time and your attention to this matter. And we are for the bill, my neighbors and I, but we're against pre-exemption. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Go ahead, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Hovey. I just want to ask either one of you, can you do reverse mortgages on with mobile homes? No? Okay.
Because it's personal property.
Right. I also forgot to say something, Representative Nelson. Mr. Dickus forgets that Thunderbird Park residents tried to buy the park, but they did not have enough money. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I want to get to the two more. Linda Ludwig, you're welcome to testify if you wish. You don't have to, but you're welcome to. And Rick Bennett, same goes for you. You're welcome to testify if you like. Oh, you can come up and just say a couple words. I want to at least get through my list.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. Linda Ludwig from the League of Oregon Cities. League of Oregon Cities represents the 242 cities across the state of Oregon. And since we're short on time, I'm going to be very concise in my remarks. You've heard from the four cities that have ordinances regarding this matter. They've done a very, very good job of articulating their concerns to you. You've heard from all four of them both today and in your previous hearing. So I'm not going to repeat what they've said. However, I'm sure it's no surprise to you that when LOC has concerns, the League has concerns, when new policies constraining preemptions are presented to the legislature for consideration. I've also heard from cities regarding the merits of this bill and additional concerns, and I am very much looking forward to a host of amendments that I think that we're looking forward to see what they do with this bill before I give you additional information. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP. I've been
AARP stands for?
Stands for AARP.
American Association of Retired.
Formally, yes. That's correct.
I'm always trying to catch you on that.
Yes, you are. I've been before you on several other bills related to mobile home parks and spoken in support of them. But I'm not quite there on this bill. I do have some concerns. I hesitate actually to criticize, or not even criticize, but to speak against work of a coalition that's obviously worked very hard over several months to get to this point. But there are a couple of issues in the bill. One, preemption, and the other, the property tax assessment freeze that I still have questions about. And I've gotten material from proponents and opponents on these issues, and I've talked to people about it, and I'm still not quite satisfied with the answers I've gotten so far. The reality is that these two issues both affect local governments, and as far as I know, local governments haven't been a part of this coalition and haven't really had the same input as residents and park owners have on this. And again, if there are amendments coming forward, I look forward to them. I'd very much like to be supportive of this bill as well as the others that I've been on, but I'm not there yet. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it, and we're all looking forward to a set of amendments. So with that, seeing no one else signed up to testify, is that correct, Steve? Right. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2735. And, committee, I'm going to stand at ease for about 5 or 6 minutes and give folks a chance to look at the 2871-1 amendment that we just got, because we will be working that bill next. So we're at ease. The House Committee on Consumer Protection back to order and open a work session on House Bill 2871. And I would like to invite up Angela Martin. And Paul Cosgrove. We ought to have you both at the same table, perhaps, but
we find each other, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for coming up today. I know this has been a bill of a lot of conversations, and hopefully you've had time to look at the Dash 1 amendments a little bit, and just wanted to open it up for a couple of comments if either of you have any. So,
for the record, my name is Angela Martin, representing Our Oregon. I had an opportunity to read the Dash 1 amendments, and they look very strong. They look like to get to the goal of closing any potential credit service loophole. We approve.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Services Association. I've only seen them for a few minutes, but in fact, I think we would oppose the Dash 1 amendments, not because they get at closing a loophole, because we would like to close that same loophole. In my letter to the Speaker, I mentioned that loophole, but because they do it in a way that, frankly, I think disturbs our ability to make real estate loans using mortgage brokers, which we do. There's been testimony from our witness from out of state that this bill doesn't affect real estate lending, but in fact it does. Consumer finance companies do make real estate loans, and I believe this means we could not make real estate loans using licensed mortgage brokers in the state who charge a fee. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anyone have questions of either these two? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cosgrove, if you could you please point out which particular section you believe would affect the ability to make real estate loans using a licensed broker?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bonamici, the way the bill is fashioned, it not only limits interest rates, it limits fees. And when you apply this to brokers, and recognizing that we have no use of brokers in terms of personal loans, but we do use brokers in terms of real estate loans, generally speaking, brokers' fees to us are going to be more than $30 for a real estate loan in the $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 range. Obviously, if it was above $50,000, it wouldn't be affected by this bill. We do make a number of real estate loans using mortgage brokers, and I think that effectively putting a $30 fee on a mortgage broker who would be selling us a loan would mean we would not be able to buy those loans from mortgage brokers. I don't know that that's the intent, but I think that's the effect.
Is that language in the original bill or in the amendment?
The original bill has a limit on $30 loan fee, $10 per hundred, maximum $30. And then when you apply that to brokers, and you think of the circumstance of a real estate loan, That's where the problem occurs, not with respect to a personal loan. We don't use brokers for personal loans.
Thank you.
Mr. Cosgrove, in real estate lending, I'm sure 36% is probably a little higher than most real property loans. Wouldn't a broker under this law be able to, or a consumer loan company be able to recover those costs and the interest rate if they felt the loan origination fee was not high enough to cover those sorts of costs?
Mr. Chairman, I think it would have potentially that result of sort of having a strange result of dramatically increasing an interest rate in order to reduce a fee. Generally speaking, the kinds of fees that brokers charge and or points that sometimes exist in real estate loans are points are paid by borrowers and generally have the ability to choose to have a loan with points or without points in order to reduce the interest rate. This would mean if you limit the points or the broker fees, you've in order to recover that cost, you would have to increase the interest rate. There's also a potential problem that I frankly haven't had enough time to think about. We don't have the authority to hide a broker's fee and an interest rate. We have disclosure requirements, and I'm not sure that we could do what you suggested, even if that was the desired result of increased interest rate in order to meet the $30 fee. I'm not sure we could do that in order to meet all of the disclosure requirements under the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, which requires us to disclose broker's fees accurately and not hide them in general. But I'm not certain enough to say that for sure.
And what would your guess be at how high that fee would have to be?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I understand your question. The fee.
Well, if the $30 fee isn't high enough for you to cover your broker's fees, then how high would it have to be?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I could answer that. I think that there would have been a way to deal with brokers and personal loans that didn't affect real estate. It's just the -1 amendment isn't that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the intent of it was to get to real estate loans. At least some of the witnesses you had said this bill wouldn't affect real estate loans. In fact, now it does. A properly drafted amendment could resolve that, but that's not the -1. I'm not sure I answered your question, but I'm not sure I have a better answer, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry.
Well, as you know, in a conversation, we were looking at trying to close some loopholes that were found in other states, and this particular broker fee happened to be one of those loopholes. And so I'm trying to think through how this is really going to negatively impact real property. If it does affect real property, I'm not sure it does, but the way I read it, I don't see that it, other than identifying a real property as a consumer loan. But I'm still not sure. I recognize your concern, I suppose, with that aspect of it, as far as the broker fee not being able to be covered in the amount of interest that's being charged for the loan.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned, I need to probably do some research that I haven't been able to do because I just saw these, but I believe the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, which is federal law with which we require or we comply, requires us to disclose as a separate item a broker fee if one is involved in a loan, and they never are involved in personal loans. They are frequently involved in real estate loans, not all real estate loans, but it's not an infrequent occasion to have a broker involved in a real estate loan. So I'm not sure that we can disclose it as something other than it is and then cover it in the interest rate. I don't believe we can, but I'm not positive.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Mr. Cosgrove, I need to ask another question because I'm still trying to get my mind about where your interpretation is coming from. Is it from the definition of consumer loan that's in the -1 amendments, because it says a loan or line of credit that is unsecured or secured by personal or real property? Is that where your concern is coming from, or is there another place in the bill or in the amendment?
which you're basing your interpretation.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bottomici, that's one place, but frankly the base bill as itself talks about Chapter 725, licensees may not charge interest of more than or a fee greater than. The base bill itself affects, at least indirectly, affects directly real estate loans that we already make. We would have a $30 loan fee problem. The amendment causes us to have a $30 broker fee problem. It compounds the problem in the base bill. The base bill already limits loan fees on real estate loans. In my example, it also regulates them on personal loans to the greater of $10 per hundred or $30. So that would have eliminated any loan fees of greater than $30. The amendment eliminates any broker fees and loan fees, which together are greater than $30.
I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that the charge is 5% or $30 instead of $10 per hundred. That's for the title lending, I think.
And
just to clarify that point.
I think you may be correct, and I apologize. But the $30 is a cap, if I recall correctly. I think you may be right, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for misstating that.
Right.
Another question?
Representative Bottomici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cosgrove, can you please give us an example of a real estate loan under $50,000 that would be something that you interpret as being affected by this?
Sure. Madam Chair, or Mr. Chairman, Representative Bonamici, Oregon's General Base Usury Law in Chapter 82 has certain exemptions, and first mortgage loans are exempted. Second mortgage loans that are equally amortized without any balloons are also exempted. So those kinds of loans would not be affected by this. But any second mortgage loan that has unequal payments and or any balloon at the end, if it's under $50,000, is covered by Chapter 725 and covered by the licensing requirements of Chapter 725. So it is those real estate loans, second mortgage loans under $50,000, that are not equally amortized. For example, line of credit loans, home equity line of credit under $50,000 made by our members would be affected by this set of restrictions.
Thank you. Any other questions? Any other comments?
One comment, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I just want to give a reminder that in many states that we've talked about, the annual percentage cap is set as an APR, meaning all fees, all associated costs of a loan are included in that 36% cap. So it's not outside of the norm to be looking at a cap of 36 plus some fees. Other states do follow the example of including all costs of the loan within that 36% figure.
Mr. Chair.
Ms.
Martin, do the other states that do include the fees, do they limit the fees and do they apply to real estate transactions or lending secured by real property?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I'm not going to be able to answer the real estate question. It was just raised with your testimony, so I can't get that answer to you right now.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you so much for the testimony today. I recognize that there may be an issue with the amount of the fee. I know this bill perhaps will have another shot over at the Senate on many of these issues, but it is my intent to go ahead and move this bill today. I'm unconvinced that there is a big issue with a 36% interest rate and making it so cumbersome to the industry that they will go out of business, as has been portrayed. So although I am concerned about your broker fee and the amount of your origination fee, I think that you can have another conversation with that on the Senate side, so I would entertain a motion.
Yeah, next session. Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the -1 amendments to House Bill 2871. Go ahead.
Representative Bonamici moves the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2871. Any objection?
Object.
So, noting that there's an objection, we'll have a roll call vote on that. And
do we have discussion?
No. I'm voting on the Dash 1 amendments right now. So, Mike, would you call the roll? And as Representative Riley has requested a time or two of always complaining about being last, he will be voting first and will be moving from right to left all week just for him.
Representative Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I vote aye.
Representative Gillian?
Stage right.
No.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative
Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative
Bellizio?
No.
Representative Girard?
No.
Chair Holby? Aye. The Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2871 are passed. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a co-sponsor of the bill, I'm concerned, even though I did move the Dash 1 amendments, I'm concerned about the application to real estate transactions, and so I will support this now, but I want to look into it further.
Thank you. I'd entertain a motion.
I move House Bill 2871 with a Dash 1 amendments to the floor. Do I have to say what it do? The two-pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves House Bill 2871 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Bellizio.
Well, I'll let Representative Gillian.
No, Mark.
No. We're starting from the right.
It's very kind of you, if it's all right for the chair.
Stage right.
Among my concerns are ones that I've voiced in here before, but I am not convinced, to use your words, that this is a comprehensive look at this problem. And the two examples I would give are the facts and figures regarding bank fees in this country and in our state. On the one hand, if we address this group and either severely limit them or drive them out, as some have claimed, then we still have a whole huge issue of where these people go. And they can go to traditional banks and end up, I believe, paying more than they're paying in these situations. It's conceivable that they could bounce checks and do a whole lot of things in traditional banking where they would seek relief. So that, to me, has to be addressed and isn't. The other side is the side I care more about, and it's what our advocacy and charitable community does. And you've heard me harangue on this, and I will say this. I was at least encouraged in the last meeting of this committee by the shining light to me are the credit unions, because they've at least put together a program that has four or five pretty impressive points to it of trying to reach out to these people who have found themselves in this situation and connect them to credit with training and all kinds of opportunities that are non-traditional. But it is a drop in the bucket in terms of people that they're meeting and the kind of coalition that has been put together. The other one that encouraged me, and I just want to put it on the record, is the Society of St. Vincent de Paul testifier, the name of which escapes me at the moment. And finally, somebody from this community came in here, and in addition to advocating for these people who are being gouged and who are caught in a cycle, stepped up and said, in addition to being here as a lobbyist, we're doing something for poor people. That impressed me. But I think we all, I'm included, we all got to step up and find ways to help these people, because if we think we're solving this, we're not. And maybe you have to get on the side of saying we're going to attack it. It's easy to get on a bandwagon and say we've got to do something for the poor. I'm all for that. But I don't believe this bill does that.
Thank you for that. And I just note while we're under discussion that we have looked at a lot of other states that do charge 36%, and, you know, I'm following George Bush's step for his military, where they have limited the loans at 36% and have had an outpouring of people who are supportive of this 36%, and that's why I continue to support it. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to sort of tag on to
Representative Gilliam here. I too have been encouraged by many of the things that I've heard in this committee from credit unions, from the advocacy groups, but for my part, I believe this bill goes a long way towards solving this problem, and certainly I hope we can do more. But I think this bill goes a long way towards it, and I'm going to be supporting it. Thank you.
Thank you. Mike, would you call the roll, please?
Representative, I've been mayor. Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to express that I'm proud that we're doing for the citizens of Oregon what we've done for our military. And having been the chair of the Committee on Veteran Affairs and working to set up the emergency relief funds, one at the Guard and the other over at the Department of Veteran Affairs, funds that were used by individuals needing help in times of crisis, I think it is so important that this bill move on. And following the last testimony at the last time we heard this, I, you know, walked the halls and told all these charitable organizations, and I haven't been involved with a number of them myself, like the good representative just mentioned. You know, it's time, I think, for the associations, organizations to set up their relief funds. You know, I'm always hesitant, you know, to ask for money on behalf of my constituents, but I'm finding that I'm, you know, it's getting much easier. And what we did was establish a fund for hope to help people in catastrophic emergencies. So I'm just saying, I think it's time for our charitable organizations to do the same. St. Vincent de Paul can do it, Salvation Army. All of these organizations can have a relief fund. These people don't have to go out then and get loans that they can't pay off. And lastly, I want to say, been there, done that. Three kids, a destroyed leg, no job, no insurance, no house. I know what it's like to be wiped out by massive credit. I'm so thankful that we're going to move this bill, and I know we'll take care of the two issues that we need to regarding different types of fees.
Thank you. I got about 30 seconds left.
But I don't need it.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Nope. 30 seconds each.
No, nope. I go ahead.
I'm concerned about some of the unintended consequences, so I'm going to be voting no here. But I reserve the right to. I'm probably going to support it once it comes to the floor. I want to send a signal to the Senate that we've got to make sure that we are closing loopholes and doing it right.
Thank you, Representative Gerard.
No, I'm done.
No.
I think we dealt with the problem in House Bill 2004. We set a 36% cap on predatory lenders. This, to me, is a solution looking for a problem, or a problem looking for a solution, I should say. The second thing is, there's no inflationary clause on this. So, say that there was an economic crisis worldwide and the inflation rate went to 30%, there's no opt-out. So 36%, even though it sounds an outrageous amount, might not be in the set of statute, I think, is a real problem. So I'm definitely going to be voting no. And this set of lenders isn't been the problem set of lenders. And to go there because of the predatory nature of some other lenders that we've already dealt with, I think, is a mistake.
Thank you. Mike, can you call the roll, please?
Mr. Riley? Aye.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye. House Bill 2871, having received the required votes, is declared passed.
Mr. Chair, I serve notice of a potential minority report.
Representative Gerard serves notice of a potential minority report. Thank you. With that, I close the work session on House Bill 2871 and adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.